Committee on Finance will come to order. And we are going to start out with Senate File 271 and let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Senator Champion? Members,
I can speak to the issue.
Members, the fiscal note that you have for Senate File 271 is not correct, but we are handing out, staff will be handing out a new fiscal note that is updated and correct. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair, if I can speak to that just briefly. There are two fiscal notes in the packet. The one that reflects the $53,000 cost is the original fiscal note on the bill. That's the one that's incorrect and is being replaced. The one that reflects the $15,000, members will recall that this bill has been heard once before by the Finance Committee, and at the time an amendment was added, and we were concerned that there would be a cost associated with that amendment. So the second amendment, or the second fiscal note, rather, that shows the $15,000 effect is the cost of the amendment and only the amendment. So the cost of the bill as it stands now is the 40 plus the 15. The math majors will calculate that as 55. So.
Okay. Members, have you found the information in your packets? We've got it's all been handed out. Senator Champion, do you want to just briefly update us on the bill itself?
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair and committee. This bill, again, is what we're calling driver's license for all, and it provides an opportunity for all folks to be able to get a driver's license, and when it comes to proof of identity, to allow for a person to use a valid unexpired passport from another country that has the necessary seals and security measures, as well as a certified birth certificate, again, that would have all the security features in place in order to make sure that the information demonstrates the person is who they say they are. And so that's what this bill is about. And remember, the amendment was going to permit on the card for to say drive for driving only or for driving purposes only, and we thought that would be important in order to make sure that it's clear not only to the user but to anyone who may see it that it's only for driving only. And with that, there are two amendments that I would like to go through. One, I know that Senator Miller will do himself, but it's the one that Senator Newman and I worked on. And if that could be handed out, that'd be great, and then I will talk about that amendment.
Okay. Do you have a Senator Champion, do you have a preference as to which amendment or just?
I would prefer to do the Senator Newman amendment first.
Okay. Thank you. Members, the A-10 amendment will be handed out.
And I'm looking for Beth Frazier, who's right there. I just want her to look at this amendment because we want to make sure that it's the most recent one.
Hey, Senator Champion.
Would you like for me to talk about the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Would you please talk about the, go through the amendment and just explain it?
So I'm waiting for the official copy. So just for some context for this particular amendment, one of the things that we made clear is that this driver's license is not to be used for anything other than for driving only. And we wanted to make sure that a person wasn't using it for voting or for anything like that, because we know that a person has to be, you know, at least 18 years of age and also U.S. citizen in order to vote. And so to provide some comfort language, Senator Newman and I and also Senator Pratt worked out this amendment along with the Secretary of State's office, which clearly just directs the Secretary of State's office to to really inform each county auditor and they all must inform all election officials and election judges hired for an election that a driving privilege license must not be used or accepted for voter registration purposes under the law. And that the Secretary of State's office shall inform each county auditor that a driving privilege license as defined in the statute must not be used or accepted. That's all it does, and that's just comfort language because we know that this particular license is only for driving only. And so I would see this as a friendly amendment.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Are there any questions on the amendment? Members? If not, Senator Champion moves the A-10 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion is adopted. You said, Senator Champion, that you had another amendment?
In fact, it's Senator Miller, and I'm happy that he's here. He has an amendment that he would like to put forward.
Okay. Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have the A-8 amendment.
Okay. Senator Miller has the A-8 amendment, and that will be handed out. Could you be sure that the author gets an amendment?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Miller,
and members, I'll just explain the A-8 a little bit. After reading through the language of the bill a little bit more, I see that we take care of the undocumented folks that are here illegally. But the language in the original bill repealed the provision that undocumented folks that are here legally on a visa, work visa, or another visa. Current law says that they can get a driver's license, and the driver's license expires the same time as their visa would. The original language that Senator Champion had repealed that, so the expiration date on their driver's license would not match their visa. And after talking to Senator Champion, it sounds like the intent of the language was to include the folks that are here legally with a visa with the other folks that are undocumented. So what this language does is it would give them the same driver's license that says for driving only or driving purposes only. I don't recall the language that we finally landed on, but that's what this amendment would offer. And I had a conversation with Senator Champion yesterday about this, and based on our conversation, he said that was the original intent of the bill. So this language just clarifies that.
Okay, thank you, Senator Miller. Any other comments that members have? Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just reading through the amendment, just making sure that it doesn't create any challenges with the existing language and intent. And it is our intent that this driver's license only privilege will be provided, and so that they all would have the same license, and therefore there would be no need to have two different licenses. And so I would like to have Ms. McCormick, if she's comfortable speaking to this amendment, just so we can make sure that it is okay.
Ms. McCormick.
you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. And I haven't seen the amendment before, but it appears that what we're talking about is that we do allow in the rules that we would still be in place if this bill would become a law, for people to be able to get a driving license with temporary legal presence documents. And it appears that that's what we're talking about, is people that are here on some kind of a visa of some nature. And
first bill.
So it sounds like they would have that same header on the card, if I'm understanding this correctly, and pay the fee that would be required in the legislation as well, it sounds like. And then the only thing, it would also expire when the person's expiration would end for their legal presence documents. The only thing that I would see that could be a concern, and maybe it isn't, it's just hard for me to just react really quickly to the fact that they may have to get a new license more often than other people if they're here, for instance, on a student visa or something like that. But it would certainly, I'm sure the intent is that it expires when their legal presence ends. And so it would, you know, it's basically what we operate right now in terms of our procedures. That's, you know, we're not taking a position on it. I'm just trying to sort through how it would work. But that's what it appears to me that it would be, that they would still show their proof of residency and documents as we already require, and pay the fee, and then that they would get the same card as the other individuals.
Let me just ask Ms. McCormick, and you can think about this for a second, because I have a question for Senator Miller, too. As you look over this, do you see any administrative burdens or costs that come up? And as you check that out, Ms. McCormick, Senator Miller, the person or persons that we're directing this amendment to, can you just give us a quick idea of who that person might be, kind of as a category? Or
Sure, Mr. Chair and members, this would be undocumented persons who are here on a short-term visa. So they might be here on a work visa or a student visa. So they're here. They don't have they're not United States citizens, but they're here legally on a short-term visa. And to the best of my understanding, and Ms. McCormick mentioned this, this is what the department is currently doing as far as the date, the expiration date would expire the same time as their visa would. Technically, their legal status in the United States.
Right. Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I think he has the intent correct. I think the challenge or the problem would only be, in my mind, at lines 2.9 to 2.11. And the reason why that would be a problem is because earlier what was a part of the testimony from Ms. McCormick and others is that once that date changes or that date arrives, there's always the possibility that the personnel is going to be allowed to be in the country longer because of an extended work visa or something of that particular nature. And then what happens is then they have to go get a new card under this provision that would potentially cost them additional money. And so, but maybe I'm right or wrong, and Ms. McCormick can speak to that.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Senator Champion is correct in the fact that the way our current rules read that are deleted as part of this legislation, if you're here on a temporary visa and you have a status check on your license, and it's the 1 or 3 year is the length of the visa, you can go in and show an updated document to us, and we provide you with a card at no charge. And then anyone that has a driver's license has to renew it every 4 years. And so when they go in at the renewal date on the card, so someone that has a status check right now still has the 4 year renewal date on that card. And if they have to come in and provide us with updated documents, then we send out a notice 60 days ahead to let them know that their status check date is coming up and they need to come back in and show us updated documents. And if they come in before the 60 days are up, then they are able to get a new card that would be issued to the expiration date, the 4 year, and we don't charge for those cards when they come back in within the 4 year period, as long as it's done in a timely manner. And so that would be the difference with this, where they would come in and would show us a new document, and then we'd have to have and then the expiration date would be the date tied to their document. So that would be the change in process that we would have with this.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, we had a slight mix-up of amendments. I'm going to withdraw the A8 amendment, and I'm going to offer the A9 amendment, which copies are being made.
Senator Miller withdraws the A8 amendment, and staff will hand out the A9 amendment. It might not be here yet, so. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, I know that when we've offered legislation to have new license plates or specific license plates made for organizations or groups or things like that, we've always asked the people that were purchasing those license plates to pay an extra amount of money to purchase that. I was just wondering, how is this extra burden that is being placed on here through the fiscal note going to be accomplished? Is it going to be absorbed by the agency, or is there an extra fee that's going to be at? Because what I see in the legislation is just a normal $17.25 for a regular license, and it doesn't seem like someone's picking up the extra charge.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson. What happens is that all the fees through the Department of Motor Vehicle and Services must be fee-based. So for an example, whatever the cost ends up being, that will be paid by the recipient of the license. So if you look at the fiscal note on the back page, it tells you that and it articulates that.
Thank you, Senator Champion. The A9 amendment is being distributed. And
Mr. Chair and members, the A9 better fits with the description that I gave a little bit earlier. And Senator Latz and I were discussing the A8, and it wasn't fitting with my explanation, and I thank him for pointing that out. And we were considering two amendments on this legislation. So the A9 is basically, it gives the undocumented citizens that are here legally on a short-term visa, they would have the same status on their driver's license that says for or driving purposes only or for driving only.
Okay, Senator.
This is the amendment that I discussed with Senator Champion.
Senator Miller moves the A9 amendment.
Can you give me just 1 minute,
sure.
Mr. Chair?
And the explanation that Senator Miller gave for the A8 amendment is the same for the A9 amendment.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the committee's patience. I will accept this as a friendly amendment with the understanding that Senator Miller. So I think Senator Miller explained it. Can you explain it one additional time so we're clear as to especially lines 1.3 and 1.4 and how that fits into the intent of the bill?
Senator Miller.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, so we're going to start from the beginning here. The language that Senator Champion is proposing in Senate File 271, this Senate file addresses the undocumented folks that are here illegally, and it provides them with a driver's license. They have to meet a certain criteria, mm-hmm. and that driver's license will say for driving only. The amendment addresses undocumented folks that are here legally on a short-term status. So if they're here on a work visa or a student visa or any other the number of visas that give them short-term status in the United States. Current law, as Ms. McCormick said, their driver's license would have a status check, which would expire the same time as their short-term visa documentation. Senate File 271 repeals that language, and what we're doing with the A9 amendment is those folks that are here on short-term status would get the same driver's license that clearly says on line 6.12 of the bill, the driver's license would be marked for driving only. They would still go through the same process that they're currently going through to get that driver's license. The only thing that would change is Senate File 271 repeals the language that their status check is printed on the driver's license. That would be replaced under the A9 amendment with for driving only.
And thank you, Senator Miller. Senator Anderson, I believe if you look on the amendment on line 1.13, I believe the question that you had asked earlier is answered there. Senator Lantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand this as well. First, perhaps I could ask for a clarification from Senator Miller, because he referred to the amendment as applying to undocumented persons. But it seems to me if they're here with a lawful status, student visa or short-term work visa or whatever, they are not undocumented. They are here lawfully. They are documented. But we're just not granting them a long-term permanent driver's license. So am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lass, yeah. So they're non-United States citizens who are here legally, so they are documented. They have a short-term status.
Okay. Then my second question, Mr. Chair, is why on line 1.7 are we calling it a duplicate driver's license? It seems to me there are two categories of people that Senator Miller is trying to address. One is those who are here lawfully. They may enter the country lawfully on a short-term visa or whatever, and we want them to be able to drive legally on our roads. And this would authorize that to happen. But there's a second category of people who enter the country illegally or overstay a lawful status and are then not legally present, but we still want them to drive lawfully on the roads. And that is covered by Senator Champion's original bill. But what the amendment here, A9, on its own terms, seems to cover is those people who are in the country not legally, who apply for this new driving privilege license under Senator Champion's bill, and then who later become lawfully present. They while they're here and they have this driving privilege license, they get a short-term work visa approved or a student visa approved or something, and they need to change the status of their driving privilege license so that it reflects that they're here lawfully. And that's what it seems to be, where we get to a duplicate situation that Senator Miller's amendment addresses.
Senator Miller?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, and you are correct. That's what the duplicate license in council can correct me if I'm wrong. But this language would say if there are if the status changes from a temporary status to a permanent status, so they go from a non-U.S. citizen to a permanent U.S. citizen, then they would get a duplicate license that would be just like every other lawful citizen.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
What I will commit to do with Senator Miller, because I know that we were talking about this yesterday and we were trying to capture our discussion, and it's difficult to do on the fly. What I will commit to Senator Miller is that if you withdraw his amendment between now and hopefully if it passes this committee and the floor, that we can work on the language and just make sure that it meets all muster and that he's comfortable and that we're comfortable, and then that way it just helps us all. Because I understand his intent, and I'm okay with trying to craft some language that is going to be helpful for us all.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, I'll agree to that. And Senator Champion and I have been working on this, and we're trying to improve the bill. And after reading it a little bit more carefully yesterday, I found that we're not addressing these folks. So I'll withdraw the amendment and continue to work with Senator.
Senator Miller withdraws the A9 amendment. Senator Champion. Senator Champion. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Champion, I see that in order to get this for driving only type of a license for documented or documented person, they have to have the proper paperwork. A birth certificate or a visa or something like that. What happens if they get stopped by law enforcement? How is law enforcement going to be looking at this for driver-only type? And maybe Ms. McCormick or somebody else can give an idea, but is this going to be a new training process for the state troopers or for the law enforcement? You can give me some background on that.
Hey, Senator or Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, well, we work with law enforcement all the time to keep them up to date on the card features, the security features we have, any change we have in a driver's license. We work with the law enforcement agencies to make sure they're made aware of those changes. Get handouts that show all the security features on the card, and we work very closely with them. This would be the same. We would do the same thing anytime we have a new version of the card, but this would be a new category. Certainly, we would spend time with the law enforcement associations, and we're able to distribute to all law enforcement officials the information.
Hey, Senator Champion, the motion, if there are no further questions, the motion would be to adopt the committee engrossment, which members as the Senate file 271 as amended. So, Senator Champion.
That's my motion.
Okay, Senator Champion moves the adoption. Oops, Senator Weaver.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I know that we've made clear that it can't be used for voting purposes. What if the card was used for identification for a purchase, if it was for alcohol or cigarettes, admission to places that require that? Because it's clear some places for compliance checks that it has to be conforming identification, but the license says for driving only. And I'm thinking, you know, there could be a case where you could have an unintended consequence if it's used for identification for the purposes I mentioned and not expressly stated in the law.
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wieger, the whole reason for putting for driving only on the card is to make it very clear to anyone who looks at it what the intended purposes the intended purpose is. And so I can't speak to every potential scenario, but again, we tried to do the best that we could by making sure it's very clear on the license in a prominent place what this license is to be used for.
Okay, on Senator Champion's motion. Any further questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same
no.
sign?
No.
Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you. Mr. Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Senator Champion, we have one more move here. We just adopted the committee report, which is the what we had before us. So now we need a motion to recommend that this pass and be sent to the floor.
And also, I'd like to add on there, Mr. Chair, that there be an appropriation for $55,000, even though it's it is my understanding we only need an appropriation for $15,000, even though that comes back by way of payment of the fees. Now, that's what I'm hearing from Ms. McCormick, and you might want to hear from her on that issue.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, it was my understanding that the fiscal costs in the bill impact to the special revenue fund were the 40 from the original fiscal note and the 15 from the amendment that went on, which have now been engrossed into the committee engrossment that you've just adopted and have in front of you. Is that a misstatement?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the last fiscal note we did took into account that amendment. It was a 5 amendment, and we talked with our card vendor, and if we're taking the status check off at the same time we're creating a new header on a card, they were willing to charge us just the $15,000. And so that's why this last fiscal note was different than the first one. The first one talked about the status check and a header, and that was what the vendor told us at that time. But now that we went back to them again just to get the costs checked with the latest draft, then they told us $15,000.
Okay, thank you, Ms. McCormick. So, all right, on the motion to pass Senate File 271,
the, as amended,
engrossed copy. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign?
No.
No.
Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you.
Next we have... okay, Senator Hayden, we have the House File 580. Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair.
So, members, in your packet, you have information, fiscal note, and you'll see the explanation is from House Research on the summary, the bill summary. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I need to move the A1 in order to insert the House language into the Senate language, if I'm not mistaken.
Senator Hayden, I believe we have the House language before us.
Okay.
And the A1 amendment has one small change to that language.
Okay.
Staff will hand out the A1 amendment.
Okay. So the A1 does not. Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was mistaken. I wanted to, first of all, thank the committee for having us today. And I guess the A1 amendment, what it does is it amends the House file. And I will move, or I guess I can't move it, but if someone would move that, I can explain it.
Senator Sieben moves the A1 amendment to House File 588.
So, Mr. Chair, on page 2, line 20, we're just inserting the language consult with the department as they study the correlation between nurse staffing levels and patient outcome. And I can go through the bill, but that is language that has been agreed upon between the two parties that I've been working with on this bill. And it's a little disjointed to talk about it, but it allows us to allow the Department of Health to consult as they deal with the study. And once again, that's kind of the end of the bill. So if you want me to go through the bill, it might make more sense, or if members are comfortable.
I think it would be helpful if you just went through the bill.
Sure.
And members can jot in the language on page 2.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. House File 588 is the Staffing Plan Disclosure Act. As many of you know, this bill started out as what many of you knew was the nurse staffing ratio bill. We have had a long journey, to say the least. But I will have to say, if I could, that the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association have done an incredible amount of work in both bodies to kind of come up with this plan that we think. I hesitate to say that there's peace in the valley. I did that one time before, and it didn't really work. But I will most certainly say that they have done a lot of work to come to agreement with this language. What we have simply done is decided to develop some definitions on what we were studying, and then that is section 1 of the bill. It just goes through what core staffing means: non-managerial care staff, inpatient care unit, staffing hours per patient day, patient acuity tool, and then what we're going to do is to have a staffing report. The chief executive or nursing designee of every reporting hospital in Minnesota will develop a core staffing plan for each patient care unit. Subsection B, or paragraph B, core staffing plan shall specify full-time equivalent for each patient care unit in a 24-hour period. And then C, prior to submitting the core staffing plan, hospital shall consult with representatives of the hospital's medical staff, managerial, non-managerial care staff, or other relevant hospital personnel about the core staffing plan. That allows them to start to report on what the staffing plans are in the hospital. And then subsection 3, standard electronic reporting developed. Hospitals must submit their core plans to the Minnesota Hospital Association in January 2014. Hospital Association shall include each hospital's reporting staffing plan on the Minnesota Hospital Association's Minnesota Hospital Quarterly website by April 1st, 2014. Any substantial changes to that core plan shall be reported within 30 days. The Hospital Association shall include its website reporting for a hospital on a quarterly basis the actual and direct patient care hours per patient and per unit. Hospitals must submit the direct care the direct patient care report to the Minnesota Hospital Association by July 1 of 2014. So essentially members were now allowing the hospital association will be working with its members to do actual reporting on their core care plans and then what happened after that. Mr. Chair, where the amendment comes in is the study. The Minnesota Department of Health shall convene a work group to, and then that's where we inserted the language, consult with the departments as they study the correlation between nursing staff levels and patient outcomes. This report shall be presented to the chairs and ranking members of the Health and Human Service Committee in the House. When it says in the House of Representatives, we may have to, oh, in the Senate, I see, by January 15, 2015. So in a nutshell, members, what we have come to is this issue that we've had about staffing ratios, which started out as us wanting to mandate hospitals to have a certain amount of nursing staff per patient. What we've arrived at, because we found that to be problematic, hospitals are so much different throughout the state, large and small levels of service. What we've come to is this report, the definitions, the staffing report, then how do they talk about it? And then we are, and what this really comes to with your committee, is we are working with the Department of Health to actually conduct a study to see if there, to kind of finally settle it, to see if there's a correlation between issues that folks are having in the hospital relative to how much care there is. The fiscal note is really the House fiscal note is to this bill, and and Mr. Koppel from the department is here if there are questions about the fiscal note. But as you can see, there is some cost there. Senator Lori said that he would track this on his spreadsheet, and I think they've done the same thing in the House. So the cost will be, in my understanding, will be or at least my understanding is Senator Lori said he was tracking that in his spreadsheet.
That's the testimony that we just received. I just addressed that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, I'm loath to disagree with you, but I do not believe that it's tracked in the Human Services spreadsheet at this point, that if the committee approved it would have to be part of the resources that are not yet allocated.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, you would know, but I'm just telling you the commitment that was made to me and was made in the testimony when it left the Health and Human Service Finance Division.
Senator Hayden, I think what Mr. Nauman and I had tracked, and been my understanding from the agency, that there was a request for a figure, I think, considerably under what had been originally requested. But I don't believe Senator Lori is not here, but I don't believe Senator Lori is tracking this within his division's omnibus bill.
So, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Nauman.
One of the decisions for the committee to wrestle with here is that the accompanying fiscal note is for salary and fringe and other operating costs and administrative services. Those are delineated on page 3 of the fiscal note in that little box. You can see that there's $187,000 of essentially administrative and salary costs in state fiscal year 14 and some salary and fringe costs in fiscal 15. So it would seem to me the decision for the committee is whether or not we would provide those resources or ask the department to eat them.
I can find them.
Okay. Sir Hayden, what we'll do is I've asked Mr. Nauman to find Mr. Albrecht just to make sure. Our sense was is that the 187, whatever it is, was not tracking, but we'll verify that and make sure we know what we're talking about. Sir Neal.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So assuming this is not tracked in Senator Lori's HHS budget, we'd be tracking this on that pile of money that exists in Mr. Nauman's computer over there on the bottom line. The concern that I have is this would be, I think, if that's the case, this would be the third bill now that we're attributing to money that's on the bottom line that we don't know what it is. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not, because we don't have a dollar figure that we've been given that says here's the bottom line that we can plug little bills into. That's not, I mean, we're not talking huge money here, but without any context, it's kind of difficult for, at least for me, and I would imagine for the committee, to keep saying, okay, yeah, let's track this on the bottom line, because we don't know what that is.
Well, certainly, you know, I can assure you that what Mr. Nauman and I are doing on a daily basis is to take a look at legislation that's come in front of the committee. I will tell you that I think I might have indicated when we had this discussion last week, we have a single bill that has a very large expenditure, and which we're going to hear toward the end of the week, and that's Senator Pappas's pension bill. And we run into a little bit of a glitch with that, and one of the reasons we're delaying it is to see where the money is. But there's no question that we're tracking these expenditures very carefully. And to be honest, it's not that the money's movable as such, but arguably we could finish the committee's work, determine there's no other need or desire to do anything else, and the money might remain at the bottom line. We could ship it over to the tax committee to put it into the budget reserve. But I can tell you Mr. Nauman is tracking this very, very cautiously and carefully. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, there's a very well-known, famous person once who said, it's not that I don't trust you, but trust but verify. I can do the trust part, but I can't hit the verify part. That's my problem, Mr. Chair.
And that, but that person wasn't a member of the legislature or a fiscal analyst, I don't believe. So I certainly, by all means, continue to question these expenditures, but I can't speak, and I think I might have indicated to you when we had this discussion last week that I'm not sure how Senator Roebling handled that. I think I'm trying to recall 2 years ago if we had some small bills that came up, and obviously Mr. Nauman was not the chief fiscal analyst. Mr. Gardner was at that point. And I think I asked, not in committee, but I think I asked privately of Mr. Gardner some of the same questions and got some of the same answers. And I guess I've always had a significant amount of respect, belief in our fiscal analysts. I've worked with them over the years, and they've never hesitated to give us both good news and bad news. And this has worked out real well, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up, Senator Nino, do we, if you're tracking it very closely, then how much have we, Senator Nino, I think, mentioned two or three bills, and I can't remember for sure, but how many bills have gone out that we put on that bottom line?
Okay. Let's have Mr. Nauman answer the question relative to this bill, and then before we vote on this bill, I'll ask him to total that figure for you.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I had a conversation with Mr. Albrecht and as well as the committee chair. It is not the division chair, I should say. This is not tracked in their budget.
All right. Mr. Nauman, I don't know if you heard the question as you came back in the room. Senator Nino and then Senator Fischbach have asked, or Senator Fischbach in particular has asked, with bills we've passed, how much have we appropriated separate from the omnibus finance bills up to this point? And we haven't passed Senator Hayden's bill, so we'll exclude that bill.
So, Mr. Chair, my data is up through yesterday's committee session. Senate technology on display.
Mr. Chair, if I...
Works on Senate technology.
It's in another bill.
Mr. Chair, relative to this bill, if I may, I just got word that if this means anything to the committee, that this bill is in the House HHS omnibus bill. Just for clarification.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be pleased to go through the individual bills.
Well, just to make sure there's complete information, why don't you go through the bills?
Okay, so Senate File 723 was Senator Pappas's DREAM Act. We appropriated $100,000. Let me give you the total first. The $357,000 of additional spending or additional appropriations in fiscal 14-15 with a tail of a negative 50.
How much is down there?
Those break out as follows. Senator Pappas's DREAM Act required an additional $100,000 in fiscal 14. Senator Hayden's Senate File 976, the Controlled Substance Nonviolent Prisoner Release, saved $120,000. And these are all 14-15 numbers. The Sexually Exploited Youth Bill, Senator Pappas's 1294, had a one-time appropriation in 14 of $300,000. The claims bill, which was considered yesterday, carried a cost of, it's a little bit of rounding here, but $21,000 is what I'm tracking on that. And then the this one is interesting. We are now carrying numbers for a Senate file and a House file that was passed and signed into law, Chapter 15, I believe. The elimination of the Reinsurance Association pre-funded limit. There was a slight cost associated with that bill that was not estimated at the time that the bill was passed and signed into law. We're now estimating a $56,000 cost for that. And that's because
And so that total would be
that's 56,000 for that.
Is there anything else?
That's all I have at this point.
Okay, so that total would be 477, if my arithmetic, my quick arithmetic is correct.
Mr. Chairman, make sure you got the negatives. I think that it's 357.
And Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry.
Because saved 120,
he
should be able to spend that now.
I'm sorry. So I can assure you, Sarah Fishbach, as best we know, we are significantly away from what money is available.
Well, Mr. Chair, then what money are you aiming at for availability?
I don't know. It depends on where we go with some of these smaller bills and what we do with Senator Pappas's bill.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused. You said you were tracking it very closely.
Well, Mr. Nauman is. I think it's somewhere 15 to 20. But, you know, this is the way, again, Mr. Nauman and I will reconnoiter when we're done with the committee meeting, and I'll make sure that what we've done properly.
And Mr. Chair, 15 to 20, we have 15 to 20.
No, I think what we'll find out, Senator Fishbach, is Senator Pappas's bill has a cost into the tens of millions.
15 to 20.
The pension
million.
Bill. That's the large expenditure. The other expenditures are relatively small.
So, Mr. Chair, there's a on the bottom line?
Well, we're not sure because, again, we've run into a problem with Senator Pappas's bill. We're working it out. I don't have an answer for you right now. And won't until we get further into the week and we had more time to work with Senator Pappas's bill. That I mean, what the House did, I hesitate to lapse into a discussion of what's happened in the other body. They set a very large target, I believe, for the omnibus pension bill. And Senator Fishbach, I think Senator Roebling handled this in the same respect, is that the pension bill passed as a freestanding bill. And I don't know, Senator Pappas, were you on the commission 2 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. Do you recall what the cost was approximately of the omnibus pension bill? You weren't involved with it. So,
you're not.
But there was some significant cost, I believe, wasn't there, Senator Pappas?
There usually is.
Yeah. And I can't recall, Senator Fishbach, if Senator Roebling, if what you did, or not you individually, but collectively, under the chairmanship of Senator Roebling, if there was if there was some money appropriated simply for the omnibus pension bill or not. What we've done historically is within this larger framework, we've appropriated an approximate money dollar for the pension bill. We haven't set an explicit target for the pension bill. I think historically the House has done it a little bit differently where they tag in a dollar figure for the pension bill. But the pension bill has always passed separately from the omnibus finance bills, and that's the single large expenditure that's always standing out there, outstanding. Anything else is relatively smaller. So, Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I noticed you mentioned that a previous bill by Senator Hayden
came in with a savings of $120,000. Maybe we should apply that to his current bill.
Well, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would certainly like to encourage Senator Hayden to find some more of those savings. I think that's the right track. But just on the conversation we've been having, so without the pension bill, which is still kind of pending, there's about $15 to $20 million on the bottom line. Is that what I'm understanding?
I think that's an approximate
roughly figure.
Okay. I believe. I'll have to talk to Mr. Dahman afterwards. But and again, there is a not insignificant problem that's developed with Senator Pappas' proposed pension bill. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, in light of Senator Miller's request, we'll be happy at some point to come forward with more early release of low-risk offenders bills that would relieve some of the burden on the Corrections Department and save money.
All right. Well, let's proceed with Senator Hayden's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair. Hayden. I'm glad to be part of this discussion. I did want to mention, Mr. Chair, if I could, that I just got a note that since this bill is in the House and it is not only passed in the House, but it's in Senator Huntley's omnibus bill, if this body should pass it and we should pass it on the floor, Senator Lori is prepared to take the House's position and put that into the overall, when we get into conference, the overall bill. So that is kind of the proposal, that is it. And the reason why, and I sit on both committees, one of the reasons why it didn't get in the omnibus bill is because our track was a little slower than it was in the House. And we've had a considerable amount of conversation with the stakeholders and wanted to be sure that everybody was comfortable before we put it into our omnibus bill, which was on a faster track than what we could do here.
Senator Ingberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know the conversation was straying away from the author of the bill here a little bit. I was going to try and bring it back. He mentioned that it's in the this was in the House bill, and we all know they're actually looking for more tax dollars than the Senate is. So there shouldn't be a problem funding it over on that side if they come through. But Senator Hayden, you're doing a lot of work on this, and you and I had talked a little bit about it briefly, and we talked about nurse staffing issues and how contentious that certainly has been, at least in the hallways here. So this is a compromise. I mean, Senator, Mr. Chair, if I can indulge just one policy question, because I know nothing about this bill. This is a compromise going forward. But is this inevitably going to be brought back to the state of Minnesota requiring staffing of hospitals? Is that fair to say or not fair to say?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I would hope not. Most certainly probably isn't something that I would ever bring back personally, but that's just on the side. That's a little levity because it has been, and the parties have been great, but it has taken us a long time to get to this point. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, on a more serious note, that's what we're hoping to do here is to not only do more reporting so that there is the transparency that I think that everybody is looking for, and I say this not to begrudge anyone to say that there isn't, but to put it in a centralized form that people have easy access to find as opposed to other ways that have been done. The second thing is the Department of Health working with the stakeholders to develop a study to try to get at this issue. We know that depending on who you talk to, they have very different stories about what's going on. That's how I got involved with it. So what this is an agreement, I would say, with the two major parties on this issue to have the Department of Health do the work that they do to try to develop a study to see if there's a correlation between the two. So, you know, I can't guarantee anything won't ever come back, but what we're trying to do is to do a deeper dive to really get at the issue as opposed to kind of what we hear in the hallways and the politicizing of this, but really try to get the Department of Health as a third party in the great work that they do to really get at this issue. And the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association, after a lot of conversation with both parties together, apart, negotiations, and a lot of intervening with not only bill authors but leadership, I think have come to a plan that we think will allow us to allow you, us as a legislature in this body to really kind of get at the core of this issue around nurse staffing ratios, or rather yet, if there is, if hospitals are staffing appropriately, and then also to start to look at if there are issues in the hospital, is that related to the staffing plan, or is there other organic things that happen? When we're all human beings, we don't know what happens when we go into the hospital. So we're trying to really kind of, in a very serious, in a very non-judgmental, nonpartisan, objective way, deal with this issue so that it doesn't continue to come back each and every year.
Thank you. And just one quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And being part of an administration that was in the staffing and going through studies, and the makeup of the plant itself has a lot to do with it. In business that I was in, of course, corners and crooks and crannies where people can hide and things like that. But I know nursing is really no different. And I'd be very interested in the study, knowing after, you know, 40-some years of living with a nurse and knowing that staffing is an issue where she has been employed. But, you know, leaving management the opportunity to make some judgment is where I'm going and where I'm concerned about, and I hope you are too, that when the patients aren't there, they're still required to have those nurses there. That would be a real injustice. Being understaffed is certainly something that needs to be addressed. But having the ability to send people home or reassign them just seems to when we start interfering with management there, it just seems to potentially drive the cost of health care. So I'd be interested in a study. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen. I think that's why we're at where we are. So we recognize that we didn't want to put any hard numbers on people. We know that hospitals are different throughout the state, and so we want to try to get the experts to take a look at that, understanding the dynamics of and the work that they have to do in hospitals.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, I too have been following this closely and have been concerned because of the fluid nature of what goes on in hospitals, that it's not just, you know, each unit or ward needs different levels of care, but also on any day you might have a difference of acuity in terms of the patient load. And so I have a little bit of concern in terms of how they're going to write their plans, taking into account the variability that happens on any given day, and just would really be concerned if there was too much rigidity in the approach. I see that you have the acuity tool as part of the discussion, but I'm wondering, I do see Mary Krinke from the Hospital Association, because I've heard from the nursing folks, and I think they're finally at peace about this, and so I appreciate, and maybe not, I guess I'd be interested in hearing, you know, from both, if they weren't okay with this approach. But then, so one piece was that staffing report based on how things are fluid and changing. And then the other is with regard to directing the Department of Health to do this working group. There's no specifics around who's on that working group. And I think that's an open question. And so I would be interested from the Department of Health, what are their intentions with regard to who might be what is the membership, and is that a balanced membership? And were there any discussions around putting those parameters in this bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoeff. I think that you're getting at kind of the core and why there may be some vagueness in some of those things that you're looking at, because it is dynamic. And so every time, to be quite frank, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, every time we try to kind of start to put some real specific language in it, it kind of created another unintended consequence with one of the groups one way or the other. So we started out probably with a lot more specificity, but then that created some problems. And I mean, if we have a couple of hours, I could probably walk you through I don't know, probably 50, 60 conversations that we've had. But the idea here is, because it's fluid, because that's dynamic, that the parties, I think, finally agreed at this language, feeling comfortable. Now, no one got, you know, like they said, in a good negotiation, no one got everything that they wanted. Everybody is, you know, has a little bit of heartburn and indigestion. But I do think that at this point, they got to a point where they felt comfortable. And trust me, we walked through this, you know, we've gone through this bill over and over and over again, even to the point of taking the House language, which did pass over there, that I hesitate to say, but I think that folks are comfortable enough with what we have here in the framework, and all the parties are here. And if, you know, if we need to hear from them, Mr. Coppo and Ms. Krinke and Ms. Gibley from the nurses are here, that every, you know, if you want to have that conversation, we can. But they all really sat down and did some really tough work, I would have to say, at getting at this point so that we can move forward. So, you know, with the at the chair and the group's pleasure, if we want to have folks come up and testify, we can. But I can assure you that this piece of legislation in front of you is something that they've all felt okay with. I won't say comfortable.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, Senator Hayden, it is the Finance Committee, and so I won't ask everybody to come to the table. But and people have been giving me their versions of nods from the from the group. So, and I think your characterization would be accurate. I can tell by the nods they're not jumping in, but they're tentatively moving forward with this approach.
Right. Senator Wistrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, sounds like a no-win situation you might be in. But I guess my concern in going forward, and I just want to get, I guess, re-clarification from you. Let me step back. I mean, hospitals and nurses, generally, there's kind of the thing in the marketplace and state law that helps regulate this, and certainly economics factors into it, but malpractice also factors into it. And I mean, there's this threat of malpractice always hanging over a hospital and nurse's head, which is really beyond just the human compassion and desire to the Hippocratic Oath, if you will, that says do everything thou shall be able to try to help somebody out. There's also malpractice that hangs over the heads of hospitals and nurses and for the benefit of patients if something does happen, heaven forbid. And so I've always been a little cautious of us going down this road. I guess Senator Senjum kind of said it the other day. Are we the statewide school board? Are we in this case the statewide board of directors of each hospital? And it really does vary. So while the study is far better than a mandatory prescription, I'm a little worried what it leads to. And so the department is going to be writing this, or are they just going to be convening this study group, and the nurses in the hospitals will be part of it? But can you just restate how
sure
that's going to be? I'm just worried that it's going to be a neutral objective from the beginning versus a hypothesis that's already been written, and we're going to just try to find supporting evidence to finish.
Sure.
Support the hypothesis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum. Well, let me first say that, you know, I think that this idea that, yeah, there is this malpractice hanging over people's heads, but that typically meant that something happened to someone and that we deal with it on the back end of whatever happened. And so I think that the nurses and the hospitals are very eager to continue to deliver good patient care and protect those that are caring for them and make sure that the hospitals can still generate the kind of revenue that they need to be able to do the work. And they're all very concerned about making sure we get it right so something doesn't happen. So though there is always the threat of malpractice, I think the way that we've been thinking about it is a much more asset-driven approach. With respect to the Department of Health, well, and then let me also say that the idea that there's some – I like to say, I look at Senator Champion, we like to talk about a guided tour, that somehow we know where we're going to end up and we're just kind of taking you on a trip. I can assure you that that's not my intent, and most certainly the group of nurses that have approached me, as well as the people that represent all the hospitals in the state, have thoroughly looked at this and have weighed in on it. And I don't think that they would not be up at the desk vehemently opposing it if they felt that that was what we were going to do. Not that the fiscal note hasn't had its problems along the way, but I think that we're at a point, because we are, and Mr. Koppel is here if he'd like to talk a little bit more on how they're going to do it specifically, if we want to get into that level of detail. But I know that they are going to get advice from all the groups. I think that they are going to kind of contract some of this out with some folks that actually know how to do this work, and then be able to bring this kind of study back and working with the groups that are around the table that have an interest in this, and really have as objective as they possibly can study about this issue. They may come back and say that they need more information or not. We don't know that, because I think that they're going to really try to take a pretty deep dive. So I think that the folks around the table are okay, and I say that lightly, because I think that each side would like to see a little bit more, a little bit less, or there's cost associated, and folks have weighed in on that. But I think that what we have in front of us, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, is an agreement that as they proceed forward, they would work with the Department of Health to really come up with an outcome that they think finally gets at this issue. I think probably what we're going to see is a study that's going to vary from region to region, hospital care, the amount of care that they give or not. That's my take. I shouldn't say that, but that's because as I've gotten into this, I know that there are just so many different levels of care, and so in a lot of different hospitals and in a lot of different regions. But we think it is important to get at this and not have some preordained outcome about what we should do. And I know that members are uncomfortable with that, but that is, the countless hours of conversation and negotiations we had with the two major parties that were very interested, stakeholders interested in this bill, and that's kind of where we've gotten.
Last question, sure. Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, so this is more just a report or recommendation, and coupled with that, could this study come back, this might sound ridiculous, but I mean, could it, if it's objective, could it come back and say, you know what, we actually think the hospitals are overstaffed in some cases?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, it could. It could say that they're overstaffed. It could say that this hospital is over, this hospital's under, this one is great. It could. In any of that, there isn't anything. The study, in the language, the study said the Department of Health shall convene a work group to study the correlation between nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes. So they want to, for instance, they could look at it and say that patients are doing really well and they were staffed just appropriately. They could say that, they had these negative outcomes and it had nothing to do with the patient, with the nursing staffing level. It could say that it had these outcomes that were negative and it was related to. We don't know, and that's why we're doing the study.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Hayden, I think we need an appropriations section to the bill. We don't have that.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I think that I was under a different understanding about how this bill was going to be tracked, and so whatever the committee's pleasure and what's most appropriate.
Well, because this is where it's going to be tracked, we need to have an appropriation section.
I can just read it. Okay.
Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chair and members, on page 2 after line 23, insert the following. Section 3, appropriation, nursing staffing, would be your head note. $187,000 in fiscal year 2014 and $65,000 in fiscal year 2015 is appropriated from the general fund to the Department of Health for the completion of the study in Section 2. This is a one-time appropriation. That would conform with the fiscal note cost.
Okay. Is Do we have a senator who wants to move that language? Okay, Senator Sieben, thank you. Senator Hayden, does that comport with what you want to accomplish?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, that does.
Okay. Senator Sieben moves the oral amendment as presented by Mr. Nauman. Is there further discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Further discussion on House File 588. Senator
Nino. Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, this may be for you or the department, the hospitals, I'm not sure. But on the fiscal note, page 2, assumption number 1, it talks about the submission and from the hospitals and definitions, inpatient acuity, inpatient care, and sufficiently granular. I'm just, what does all that mean? What is this? What's driving the $187,000 cost? What is? Are there costs that are going to have to be eaten by the hospitals? What about that,
Mr. Chair, Senator Nina? I'd probably like Mr. Koppel or one of his representatives in the Department of Health to maybe help us define what that means.
Commissioner Koppel, did. Commissioner, if you could just identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the deputy commissioner, and with me is Diane Rydrick, who's the division director for our health policy, who would oversee the study. So I'll be brief in my comment around granular, because I have a granular view of this and a different definition of granular, maybe. But I would say what I want to impress upon the members is that we do not have any preconceived notion of what this would be. We know that this will be a study that will be defined really in consultation with the work group and asking the work group as we proceed. What information and how we would go about getting effective information. So I turn over to Ms. Rydrick, and she may be able to give you more detail as to what that might look like.
Ms. Rydrick, if you could identify yourself, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And Mr. Chair, Senator Ninau, I would just echo what Mr. Koppel said. We do envision this being really a consultative process. We often do find ourselves as the convener of work groups when a topic is fairly controversial, which I think this one meets the bill. And we do really want to make sure that the evidence guides us and that the input from the work group is taken into account as much as we're able to make sure that we come up with a study that is robust and that will help the body to answer the question. So that we don't have to rely on anecdotes. In terms of sufficient granularity, I think that's really to be determined in consultation with that work group. We don't know at this point whether we'll need to have data at a shift level or a unit level. That's all part of the discussion that we need to have in order to determine what sort of data we need to collect to ensure a robust study.
Thank you. Further discussion on House File 588. If not, Senator Sieben moves that House File 588 as amended be recommended to pass. There's no further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hayden, then you've got Senate File 1272. Is that correct?
I do.
Okay. And there is not a division report on this bill. So, Senator Hayden, if you want to present the bill.
Sure.
If there's testimony you wish to have offered.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1272, the Healthy Homes Initiative, in 2012, Mr. Chair, hundreds of people across the state helped to develop a healthy home strategic plan for Minnesota. This bill will begin implementation of this plan so that citizens of Minnesota can realize the many benefits of healthy homes. The impact of the home environment on health has been known for a very long time. In the 1800s, Florence Nightingale observed that the connection between health and the dwelling of the population is one of the most important that exist. Early public health efforts have focused on the preventive disease such as cholera, typhus, tuberculosis through improved living conditions. More recently, there's been an increasing attention that the impact of the home environment has on illness that are problems today, including brain damage, learning and behavioral disabilities, asthma, allergies, injuries, poisoning, and lung cancer. All across the country, there are successful efforts to address housing-related health conditions, improved health, and reducing health care and education costs. Americans spend 90% of their time at home, indoors, and most of that in their homes. Working with people to improve their environment of their homes will improve people's lives and save health care expenses for us all. Mr. Chair, the Minnesota Department of Health is here, and also Dan Newman from the Sustainable Resource Center, to the bill. Essentially, the bill will appropriate healthy housing grants that will help individuals throughout the state develop plans to create their homes that will be free of the things that we know make people ill. So with that, Mr. Chair, if we need more information, I'd be glad. And if you have questions of the experts, they're here.
Well, Senator Hayden, because this wasn't heard in division, maybe Mr. Newman could just offer a couple of minutes of testimony as to what advocates anticipate with the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fishbach.
Yes, question. That would be appropriate.
Sure, I was going to get to that, but obviously.
Mr. Chair, where is this
point? Actually, in the bill, it's more like 3.3, 3.4. It's my understanding.
Okay, well,
this one
also is on
the
side. So
no. Actually, Senator Fishbach, I've just been told by Mr. Nauman that the number is considerably less. It's more like a third of what you're seen in the bill itself.
And Mr. Chair, I was just curious, because we've been doing that a lot with the fiscal notes. We just kind of, that there was a discussion
earlier in the session regarding the fiscal notes between you and Senator Meenow, but we're just kind of, this one says 1.6, but now you say we're just going to revise this into something different.
Well, I guess I wanted a little bit of testimony on the bill initially, and then obviously get into a discussion of what the bill costs, possibly ask the agency to testify as to why they're looking for less. The fiscal note that was promulgated has a figure of about 3.2, 3.3, which I think is reflected. I haven't added up. I think that's in the appropriation section of the bill. But it's my understanding that what's needed, I'm not sure how. We've got the fiscal note in front of us. We can ask for a distinction as to why the suggested cost is considerably less. I was hoping we could have a couple of minutes to discuss the bill and then get into the appropriations, if that's okay.
We're going to try to focus back in on the finances.
Well, obviously, although, again, this bill had not been heard in division, so I thought it was appropriate to at least have a couple of minutes just on the policy because it wasn't heard in division, and then we're going to get to the appropriations immediately after that.
And, Mr. Chair, why wasn't it heard in division?
I don't know. I think there was a concern relative to the target and room within that target, I believe. But Senator Lurie's not here, so.
I thought it was too.
I'm informed by
Mr. Chair, if I may, just I was just talking to staff. I think what happened, and we had a lot of bills in HHS division, is that it did get hurt in division. It was laid over, and it just did not make the omnibus
okay.
Bill. If I just for the record,
all right. And you serve on the division, is that correct, Senator Hayden? And I think the only person we have on the division who's on this committee is Senator Lurie.
Yes.
So, Senator Hayden, that being the case, if you heard it in division, then you had testimony at that time. Is that
we
correct?
Did have testimony at
okay,
that time.
I'm sorry.
It was heard in policy and in the division. I think it's a great bill. It just didn't because, relative to the targets.
Okay. Well, that being the case, let's – I apologize.
Chair, may I just ask Senator Hayden a question, Mr. Chair?
Certainly, Senator
Fishbach. Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, you said it was heard in division and it was laid over. Was it acted upon in mid-year then? Or I guess I'm – curious as to the track of the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Fishbach, I don't know if I'm able to answer that question. I just know that that I got a note from my office saying that that as we process, if we went through this process, that it was to be heard in this committee today. So I just
okay. So Senator Hayden, let's Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the discussion in the division have come up with a division report? We've seen a lot of division reports come here for approval.
Not if it was laid over, there wouldn't be a division report. So, Senator Fischbach.
Can you lay over a bill? I mean, is the way the structure this year of the committees is that a bill laid over in division is okay to hear here without further action? Is that
of course. Structure? Of course.
Okay. Just checking, Mr. Chair.
The divisions.
Sure. Because Mr. Chair, if we're just, if a bill doesn't make it into the omnibus bill, if we're just going to hear them here so that we can put them on the bottom.
Have you put in a hearing request?
Most likely, Mr. Chair, I have.
Okay, then we're likely to hear the bill. Mm-hmm. You don't want.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the public offer, and I will go back to my office and check because if Senator Hayden's bill, just because it wasn't heard in or wasn't included in the bill, is now being run on a separate track. I guess that's dual procedure.
We'll check, and if we have a hearing request from you, we're likely to hear the bill.
Mr. Chair, I just was handed a piece of paper with a number on. I have no clue. So, Mr. Chair, I do not know what.
Okay, well, tell you what, Senator Fischbach, could we maybe hold off on this until after the hearing, and we'll figure out if we have a hearing request from you, and we'll.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that we should understand exactly the process, so everybody should.
Well, let me make it very clear, and I've made this clear at least several times this session. All the finance divisions are divisions within the Finance Committee. The only committee that's established in the Senate rules, or the Senate rules, the Senate organization adopted on the floor, is the Committee on Finance, and like any committee that has subcommittees within it, it's within the prerogative of the committee and the chair to have a bill heard within the full committee. It doesn't have to come through a division. The divisions are entirely within the Finance Committee. I've gone through that several times before.
Well, but and Mr. Chair, I appreciate you going through it again. I just want to be clear because I guess, Mr. Chair, this potentially could be, is it this the first time? Or I mean, I guess I don't recall this, that a bill that was laid over is now being heard in full finance. So I just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being patient.
This might be the first time this session. It won't be the last time. And it's certainly not the first time over the last X number of years and or decades I've been on the Finance Committee. That's my first year on the Finance Committee. I don't know, back in whoever's administration. That happened with great frequency, much more frequency than it happens now. We did it all the time. And that's well before my becoming chairman. So I learned that from Senator Miriam. For those of you who remember Senator Miriam. Okay, so relative to that caught everybody. So relative to the appropriations for this bill then, maybe we could have some discussion from the commissioner again. But, Mr. Nauman, you spoke to him about what seemed to work or not work. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I did.
Okay. And could you indicate, Commissioner, do you mind testifying again? Mr. Nauman, what did Commissioner Koppel indicate to you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in fairness, I proposed the question if we were to spend $500,000 a year on this bill, what would be the proper breakout in Section 2? And it's my understanding that the agency, this is not in the governor's budget, so I consider this necessarily an overt endorsement, but more in terms of how to make the requirements of the bill work within a smaller appropriation. Paragraph A would be appropriated at $100,000 a year, paragraph B at $300,000 per year, paragraph C at $100,000 a year. So that would spend $500,000 per year.
Sir Hayden, Commissioner, is that are those numbers accurate numbers? So, Commissioner, why does that number allow you to accomplish what Senator Hayden has talked about, or maybe you could just offer a little bit of testimony relative to that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this initiative, Healthy Homes Initiative, was and still is part of the department's push forward. We had initially asked for this as part of the governor's budget. It was not included. We have moved forward with a Healthy Homes Initiative anyway, because what Healthy Homes means, in addition to the grant monies that are being requested today, is really to consolidate the work that we do in quite distinct silos now. For instance, we go in and do lead testing in a home, or we go in and may do radon testing in a home, where this would consolidate the effort and train staff in nonprofits and local public health to go in and do comprehensive house assessments so that you get a healthy home assessment as opposed to these individual ones. This was driven by a recent $300,000 cut from the federal government to the Department of Health and a proposed $400,000 cut to the Department of Health, the first being in lead testing and the second in radon. So we are going to be living with about $1.5 million of cuts to those programs. We believe that we can carry on the work by consolidating and doing this as a healthy home initiative. The we have been in contact and working with the Housing Finance Agency and others to figure out the best way that everybody stepping into homes to do assessments of one type or another are going to be doing eventually this healthy home assessment so that, again, we get that strength by coordination. Ultimately, the monies in this bill would be enough to begin the program because this is a scalable program. The first $100,000 of training would be to train those local public health organizations as well as our nonprofits that we give grants to on how to do healthy home assessments. The second $300,000 would be direct grants to local public health agencies and nonprofits to conduct those. And the last $100,000 would be used by the department to offset to administer the program and continue assessing and collecting the data that we get back from those assessments that are being done locally. So of the $500,000, $400,000 goes out in grants per year, and $100,000 stays with the department.
Okay. Sir Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Koppel, it sounds good. It sounds like it would ultimately save us money, and it sounds like important work. Question I would have with regard to the $100,000 that would be used to administer, does that mean that your staff that you currently have couldn't administer it, that you would have to add staff? You don't see a way to shift priorities and include that in some current staff members' duties?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, we are hoping to salvage staff at this point with the cuts that we have received. What we do internally with the data that comes back is, for instance, if there's a report, a child with a high lead level test, we will then follow up with local public health to make sure that there's there's follow-up for that child in terms of a home inspection for lead. What changes is now that follow-up will be a home inspection where we may look at mold, radon, lead, where it would be a more comprehensive check. In the implementation of this expansion and program and coordinating with the Housing Finance Agency, it isn't so much, I know it sounds, and I'm, we're willing, we're so excited about going forward. If this money gets shifted to grants, it gets shifted to grants. I'm not going to argue about that. I would say, though, that in order to run a program well, you do have to have centralized staffing. We are losing
$1.5 million approximately dollars a year coming down from the federal government for all the lead and radon testing we've done without any state appropriation. This has all been a federal effort, and that's how we've done all our lead testing to date. So this is a modest amount when you think about both the grants and the infrastructure necessary to carry it forward. Again, though, I would say because this was an initiative of the department originally and we still are excited about coordination and consolidation, we want to go, this to go forward, and we certainly don't want, if something appears to be self-serving, we don't want that to stand in the way.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Koppel, did you, just so I know a little bit more about what we might be beginning here, is it the, you kind of tiptoed toward a couple comments about expanding an assessment process of, is it every home in the state of Minnesota or new construction, or is it, tell me the scope of what the department would like to eventually do in this area.
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm going to ask someone to come up because I'm afraid I might stray from all the facts. But I would say that it isn't different than what we do now in specific areas. So, for instance, we do a lead assessment or a radon. These different assessments we do, it would be when we go in to do one, we might be able to do more than that in that particular case. So if we're going in a home that's being checked for high lead, that there would be a radon assessment done at the same time would actually be more efficient than going in through two separate funding sources the way it goes now. It wouldn't be every house in the state. These are all follow-up generally or at someone's request.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
So it's basically by an invitation of what, the homeowner or another government health personnel that would trigger the assessment?
I'm going to,
all right.
Mr. Chair.
Scott.
Senator Limmer, I'm going to ask our technical expert, Jim Kelly, here to talk about that.
Mr. Kelly, if you could identify yourself, please.
Good morning. My name is James Kelly. I'm the manager of environmental surveillance and assessment at the Department of Health. And Mr. Chairman, Senator, typically these home assessments are triggered by an event such as a child who is tested with an elevated blood lead, and then there is a response on the behalf of local public health that goes in and tries to identify sources of lead. As the Deputy Commissioner has said, by expanding the ability of that inspector to, look at a whole variety of housing-related health hazards, it will allow us to address that at the same time in a more holistic manner and actually create a safer housing environment for the child. It's known that children with elevated blood lead are also much more likely to have asthma. So if we can at the same time be looking for asthma triggers and helping provide information to address that, we're going to do a lot more to improve the health of the child that's been tested with an elevated blood lead at the same time.
Okay, Senator Edwardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had testified earlier with regards to the FedsNut funding, some dollars here, the program. And now I see on page 2 of the bill we'll be looking to implement and help local health boards of health. Can you explain the boards of health to me? Is that a county or city entity? And It just sounds kind of like the same old thing. Now the feds put out these recommendations without any funding, and when the state now does funding to local boards, is that going to be something that we're going to mandate to them and without any funding, or am I kind of going down that path? Or tell me it's not going to happen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, it's not going to happen. It would be the short answer, but the reason being is local boards of health are who we work with now and who do these follow-up now, who receive funding now, and this would be just a continuation of the work that they do. And in Ramsey County, in testimony, there was a pilot project where they have been doing this and moving in this direction. So it's actually in coordination with local public health agencies who are our partners in this process.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up, if I may. Describe to me the federal funding that's dried up that you talked about.
Mr. Chair. Senator, the federal money comes to us through the Center for Disease Control is usually how the process works. They are funded and have specific areas within the center that look at lead or other. They have a similar infrastructure to ours, and so they have through sequestration and in prior years had cuts, and that has ended in them making the decision to no longer fund the lead surveillance that we do. The lead surveillance is what we basically is the testing, you know, monitoring of children for high lead and then referral. The additional cut in the proposed budget before Congress now is an additional $400,000 cut per year. These are all per year in radon assessment. And again, for similar reasons, they've had significant cuts and have determined that this is an area that they're going to cut to states. Now, I want to be clear that this initiative at Healthy Homes has been building with local public health. It's been piloted in local public health, and it was coming forward as a way to coordinate and collaborate and do our work better across sectors before these cuts occurred. And the effort to move this forward is what's reflected, I believe, in this bill. Our interest in Healthy Homes and this collaboration coordination going forward. But as I said, this is not specifically our bill because it was not included in the governor's budget. So I'm speaking to it as a fan of the bill.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions from the bill that I wanted to ask. The first one is on line page 2.6. This talks of who this grant would be going to, and it would be to an organization with expertise in providing outreach, education, and training. I don't know how many of those organizations are around the state, but if there was an organization or a business that was just getting into this field, would they be restricted from applying for the grant due to that definition?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lemire, no, they would not.
Even though they don't have experience in providing and they wanted to?
If they were a startup organization, I believe that would probably be based on their application and what, you know, experience does help if we were in the selection process to get the best for the money, limited funds, that would probably be a factor.
The other question that I had is on line 2.33, that the screening services and prevention measures would be provided to populations at high risk for housing-based health threats. I'm not necessarily too concerned about who that population would be, but how would that be determined?
Chair, I'll ask Jim Kelly to answer that, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, currently we do define populations that we consider at high risk, for instance, of lead poisoning based on the likelihood that they live in housing that was constructed prior to 1978, which is more prevalent in some parts of the state than others. There are similar criteria we can look at in terms of other housing-related health threats, such as radon. We know certain areas of the state tend to be at a little bit higher risk than others, and there are other housing-related health threats that we can sort of prioritize in that particular fashion as well.
So, Mr. Chair, there's actually evidence that you would rely on and assess to determine where the highest risk would be. Is that correct? All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the witnesses? Cernino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, I had the luxury of seeing this, I believe, in the HHS Policy Committee, and in that committee, I suggested looking at your definition of housing-based health threat because the definition that was in the bill at the time would define, by definition, running water would be a housing-based health threat. Has that definition been tightened up any, or is it still the same?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Nienau, now I that seemed like ages ago, and so I'm when we had that, and so I'm not sure that we have come to a way in which to tighten that up. I think in some discussions, and it was right after our hearing, which was some time ago, we hadn't really gotten there because with your analogy, which is true, by the way, but then, I mean, that could be just about anything. And so we just didn't find a way, and I'm always open for suggestions if this body should pass it before it gets to its next stop, which I think would be floor, to look at that. But we just couldn't figure out a way in which to narrowly define it without then having unintended consequences down the line.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, without getting too deep into the policy here in the Finance Committee, but what I was referring to is line 1.14, the definition of housing-based health threat, that a chemical, biologic, or physical agent with any kind of acute or chronic exposure levels. My concern there was that definition is so broad that quite literally running water would be defined as a potential housing-based health threat because there's a condition usually associated with those that have some sort of psychological problems, but it's hyperhydration, people that can't stop drinking. And if you drink too much water too fast, you will then suffer from what is called hyperhydration, which creates an electrolyte imbalance, which can result in brain swelling and ultimately result in death. And with a definition this broad, almost anything. And the other example I used was a bottle of Jack Daniels sitting in the cupboard. You know, if someone were to grab that and down the whole thing, you know, you could die. And so that was my concern that I expressed at the time.
Okay. All right. I keep on forgetting, Senator Hayden, that you're not a member of the Finance Committee. So we've had the proposed changes relative to the appropriations section. So, Mr. Nauman, do you want to just give us the numbers again? It's been a few minutes.
Yes, so, Mr. Chair and members, if what I spoke to before is your pleasure, on line 3.5, you would delete 400,000 in both occasions and insert 100,000. On line 3.9, strike 800,000 in both occasions and insert 300,000. On line 3.13, strike 450,000 in both occasions and insert 100,000.
Senator Sieben moves those changes. For those keeping score, Senator Nienau, that would be an additional $1 million well within the money we have. So on the amendment, if there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1272?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
Senator Hayden, how does radon fit into this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I'll let Mr. Kelly, Mr. Koppel talk about it, but it does fit in the when he talked about the holistic nature of what they're looking for. But for more specifics, Mr. Kelly, if you'd like to.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, radon is a well-identified housing-related health hazard here in Minnesota in particular. And this funding would allow us to continue public education and outreach and promoting radon testing and mitigation of addressing radon problems in Minnesota. Those are the elements that were previously funded by the Environmental Protection Agency under the State Indoor Radon Grant that is Commissioner Koppel stated is proposed to be phased out in the president's budget. So this would allow us to maintain at least a portion of those public education activities.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz,
is there a reason why radon testing is not mandated upon the sale of a home now? Like there's a lead addendum?
Mr. Chair,
bigger discussion.
Commissioner,
I'll take a stab at that. I can't answer your question as to why it's not. We have proposed this year, and it is in our policy bill that has passed the Senate, which does, during a housing transaction, state whether or not there has been, to the knowledge of the owner, the seller, there has been a radon test on the home. So it is emerging in the process. There was legislation introduced that not our own, but was introduced that would mandate that. It did not pass that I know of. But this piece
was part of our policy initiative. So we are trying to increase awareness. We are trying to do more outreach and raise that level of testing.
Okay. Further discussion? Somebody wish to move the bill? Nobody? So, okay. Thank you, Senator Lyons. Senator Lyons moves that Senate File 1272 as amended be recommended passed. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Commissioner Mr. Kelly. Okay, we have Senator Schmidt is here. And this is Senate File 796, the Game and Fish Bill. Senator Thomas only moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Schmidt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. 796, indeed is the omnibus game and fish bill, and it's the result of many hours of work, and we have in here, I'll go over the highlights rather than the section-by-section preview here, but we have the DNR policy bill, including in this is a lot of provisions for aquatic invasive species protections, also license provisions for critically ill and veteran hunters and fishermen, also watercraft and riverboat definitions included in this bill, spear and bow fishing provisions as well, encouraging youth fishing and hunting through a number of different provisions, also some safety guards in here, blaze orange requirements for hunting, etc. In committee, in the finance division just last week, there was an amendment made to add scopes on muzzleloaders, so that's currently in this bill. And there was also an amendment to remove some trout stream protection language that I found to be unfortunate, and that's something that I'd like to talk about here today if we get a chance. That's just the overview of the bill here before us. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to field those at this time. Otherwise, I know we do have some testifiers who would like to speak to the bill.
Okay, Senator Schmidt, Senator Westrom, did you?
Mr. Chair, I just taking note of the overview of the bill, and he's talking about what's not in the bill. Typically, the overview includes what is in the bill, as I generally have understood. But
that's a pretty long.
I just want to make note of that. We don't usually make a habit of telling committees what's been taken out in all the committees. That's not what's in front of us for consideration.
Well, Senator Schmidt, if you'd like to elaborate on that, that would be welcome. I should also mention, for some reason, we don't have a fiscal note in our packets, I don't think. Does everybody have, does anybody have one except me?
I have one.
I got one.
Or is it? Oh, I'm sorry. It's attached to the Mr. Nauman didn't have one, so. All right, I'm sorry.
It's right here.
There's a minor fiscal note attached to this, but Senator Schmidt, do you want to
Chairman, we would never
elaborate?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, to your question, we did spend quite a bit of time in the Game and Fish subcommittee working on policy provisions to put in this bill, and the bill was also heard in the Energy and Environment Policy Committee. And we felt pretty good about the language that we had in here. We had several hearings. The language was vetted. We had an opportunity to hear from testifiers on both sides of the issues. And I was disappointed to see a couple of amendments at our first stop in Finance Division last week. And there was an amendment made to put scopes on muzzleloaders on the bill, and we did not hear any testimony on that in any of our subcommittee hearings or the Energy and Environment Committee. And as you may know, there was an amendment to remove some thoughtful trout stream protection provisions that get at a concern in my area in southeastern Minnesota. And I guess that was a disappointment to see a policy decision made in a finance division. And I understand that that's become a bit of a problem around here, and I certainly was disappointed to see that. So that's what I was referring to, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair.
Talking to Senator Sieben. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schmidt, what else are you disappointed then? While we're talking about disappointments, why don't we talk about the subcommittee? What did the subcommittee not put in this bill?
Mr. Chair,
if this is going to be how we want to present
it. Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I began with the highlights and the overview and what's in the bill, and I'd be happy to chat about that. I guess I was giving an overview of what's in the bill and the process that led us here today. So if you'd like to speak about what's in the bill, I'd be happy to do that. I just wanted to give folks a background as to how we got here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schmidt, I just was finding it funny that we were talking about stuff that came out of bills in prior committees. That's my point.
Your point's duly noted. Thank
typically,
you,
that's not the highlights of a bill. What's missing from it?
Okay. Further questions for Senator Schmidt? further discussion on the bill? Senator Nino.
And Madam Chair, I just was wondering, there's a 11,000 or 15,000 or something. $15,000. What are we spending that money on?
Senator Schmidt.
There's quite a bit of rulemaking authority that's granted to the DNR in this bill, and I'm sure we could have since this is from their policy bill, I'm sure we could have them up here to elaborate on that rulemaking if you'd like, but and also lost revenue as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, actually, typically rulemaking authority or exemption from rulemaking is supposed to be reviewed by my committee. So I'm just checking this. Could you talk a little bit more about the rulemaking just for my sake?
Sure. And Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, actually, this bill was before your committee.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad.
It was a long day, and it was several weeks ago, and I think it was right before deadline. So
I should have looked.
I can attest to this having
first.
A thorough vetting in state and local government.
Great. Thank you.
See, I'm not the only one.
Okay, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. 20th. The revenue reductions that are in this bill, the $15,000 loss of the Game and Fish Fund, is from a proposal that we have to reduce the fees for non-resident youth hunting in the state of Minnesota. Right now, youth hunters have to pay $5 for a license. We feel it's appropriate to make non-resident youth at the same level to help support tourism and to do that recruitment retention across all age groups, no matter what state they come from. So we look at it as an opportunity for recruitment and retention, not only within Minnesota, but to bring people into the state to hunt and fish as well. You may see advertisements from other states that say, come to our state and your kids can hunt for free or things like that. So it's a recruitment and retention activity that the minimal revenue we feel will replace many more times that we're foregoing by reducing these hunting rates for youth of non-residents.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Lumber.
Mr. Chair, do you have that same provision toward a fishing license for having out-of-state youngsters have a free fishing experience as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, under 16 you do not need a license. No matter where you come from, you can participate under your adult license that you do have. And then we also have youth resident and non-resident fishing licenses as well.
Well,
They're equal, I should say. So, yes.
So you treat youth hunters the same as youth fishermen?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yes. So right. It's across the board.
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Westrom's point, I just wanted to say something that's in the bill, Senator Schmidt, that I'm pleased about. I've had a constituent for the last few years bring to me the desire to have veterans be issued permanent deer hunting licenses. We do issue that for fishermen, and so I'm very grateful to the DNR, for particularly Mr. Myers, for working with me on that, and for Senator Schmidt for including it. In Section 26, there is a provision that allows veterans to receive, upon request, an annual or permanent license. And then, of course, they still have to go get their tags each year. But it certainly was important to the veteran in my community, and I'm sure it is to the veterans around the state. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Meyer. Is it not also that we reduced another fee here too? Was it the larger license fee or the combination fee? And we dropped that a couple of dollars because we had raised it last year, and
Mr.
determined by your office that it was too high.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, we are correcting the fact that in our original license increase proposal that was passed last year. The license you're talking about is a super sports license. It's where you can buy all of your licenses in combination together. The original number that we had reflected the department's fishing license fee increase, and through the process of the legislative bill of the bill passing, the fishing license was reduced. The increase to the fishing license wasn't as much as the DNR had requested. This was an oversight. We forgot to correct this section. So right now the price of this license is more in total than the individual licenses would be. And actually on our website we're telling people that if you buy this license it costs more than if you bought all of the licenses individually. So we're just correcting that price within the statutes this year to deal with that situation.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add something to Senator Bonham's comments, and that's that this is disabled veterans.
Oh,
not,
thank you.
Not just veterans. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, thank you.
Just one, all right, one more comment, if I could, Mr. Chair, and members should know that the retailers that sell these licenses was not addressed last year. I think it's addressed in this bill. We raised that to $1. Is that correct, Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we clarified the amount that they can collect as kind of a collection agent fee.
Right.
And actually, there were some licenses they weren't collecting fees on. So we didn't raise the base amount. We made sure that every license that they issue, they can collect that $1. Then there's also language where if you use a credit card, that's existing law, they can charge a transaction fee, so to speak, to cover their transaction costs on their credit cards.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 20, line 3 and 4, could you explain the penalty that's there?
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the same penalty that we would have for the trespass right now. I believe it would be a misdemeanor. What we're doing is clarifying the language that gross misdemeanor, I'm sorry. Mr. Knopf can expand on that more if we need to. But we're just clarifying that how the trespass language would work. So it's not changing the penalty, but it's just clarifying the language that says knowingly enter for outdoor recreation purposes. Any land is posted without first obtaining permission. So
is the knowingly enter, is that it's new language here, but is it a new definition?
Mr. Chair, maybe I could better answer that. Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, no, if you look at 97A315 subdivision 1 paragraph B, you'll see that the penalty is already in law. It's already that knowingly enter for outdoor recreation purposes is a gross misdemeanor. What this does is puts a cross reference into the statute where that people might be looking at for trespass. It puts it in the trespass law so people will know it's there. Because currently, if you look at the trespass law, you wouldn't necessarily know. It's actually in a different chapter of law where the penalty is. So this provides a cross reference to that. It is not a new penalty.
And Mr. Chairman, will that then become published in the DNR's handout book?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, I don't know if they have the penalties, but they are required to put trespass law information into that book.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, we will update that with any changes that take place within this bill, but we have a very detailed 3-4-5-page section every year within our hunting synopsis that outlines trespassing and what people need to do to follow those laws.
Okay. Further, Senator Saxog?
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, if there's no other financial agreement discussion, I would move the Senate file 796 be passed and sent to the floor.
Okay. We have Senator Saxog's motion in front of us. Senator Wieger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I didn't bring any amendments, but I just wanted to note for a record a couple of items that I couldn't get hearings on that I think it's more of a rural metro issue. Animals that, particularly dogs that have died through traps that I don't think was the intended consequence of changes that were made to address that. If you are a family that has lost an animal through that, you know what we're talking about. And another item is continuing the season for wolves. I'm happy there's the moratorium for moose. Do we want to wait till they're extinct? Now we have a moratorium there. I did have a proposal to at least have a moratorium on hunting of wolves in the boundary water. It wasn't heard. The trapping, the hunting, I guess it'll continue, and I hope our grandkids see them someday.
Okay. Further discussion on Cernino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 27, there's a report to the legislature where the commissioner has to take a look at the cost of dealing with, the destruction of escaped farm cervid, that's elk, deer, things like that. I looked in the fiscal note. I didn't see a cost associated with that. Maybe I missed it. But is the department going to eat that? Usually when we see a report, the department tells us it's going to cost them money. I just was wondering about that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Serenino, good question. That actually section was deleted in the committee report, and that report is essentially going to be taking place. We don't need to put it in statute. There's a conversation ongoing outside of this building, and we feel as though it's going to be addressed that way. Thank you.
Further discussion. Sarah Seaman.
I'd like to move the A-17 amendment.
Okay. If we could have that distributed, if it's available.
Sure. And Mr. Chair and members, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to speak to this amendment if we could.
Okay. It's a fairly simple amendment. It deletes lines 18 and 19.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it deletes lines 18 and 19 of the division report, which in turn deleted sections 50 and 51 of Senate File 796. And sections 50 and 51 are the trout stream provision that I had referenced previously, referred to as the Driftless Area Water Resources Protection Language. Essentially, what we're doing is asking for three specific state standards here to protect a very sensitive region in southeastern Minnesota. The first is, looking at Section 50 here, it's a one-mile buffer, essentially, of silica sand mining away from any trout streams or similar water features. And moving on into Section 51, we have a requirement that the commissioner may not issue water use permits for silica sand mining in this region. And third, we have a prohibition of silica sand mining within 25 feet of the water table in this region. We've had a thorough discussion here this session about sand mining in southeastern Minnesota. I've maintained that there's a place for it, that it's been happening in Minnesota for a number of years. But we have an opportunity right now to get this right, to anticipate the challenges that we're seeing just across the river in western Wisconsin. And as it pertains to southeastern Minnesota, we have a very sensitive resource. It's known as the Driftless Area, a karst topology, quick access from the surface level down to the water table. We have an abundance of trout streams and sensitive water features. And what we want to do is put in place a specific standard that protects the trout streams and similar water features, but also leaves in place plenty of room for sand mining. And this is, the certainty that we're looking for in this discussion. It's showing local decision makers and mining interests where it's appropriate to mine sand in southeastern Minnesota and where it's more sensitive and where areas should be protected. That's why this language was put in place, because we have the trout streams in southeastern Minnesota that are very sensitive to changes in temperature, sensitive to particulate in the water, and we want to make sure that we protect this resource that we have. Having carrying this bill, I couldn't possibly move forward without protecting the trout streams, and these are common sense standards that we feel will do the trick. And Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers who'd like to speak to this if we have a chance.
Sarah Fishbach. Sarah Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fishbach, I serve on the policy division, and this was adopted by, this provision was included in the Senator Marty's, it was passed in Senator Marty's committee, and then it's my understanding was taken out in the Senator Tomasoni's finance division, so I do think it's appropriate that we have the discussion about whether it's good policy and reinstating it back here in this committee.
Senator Fishback?
Mr. Chair, I mentioned before the issue of policy.
Well, Senator Fishback, here's my concern with this amendment, because I'm not unsympathetic to your comment, but if this was a policy issue brought into the division by the policy committee, and then it was undone within the finance division within the finance committee, if they undid and I want to hear some discussion from Senator Schmidt or folks who would provide some testimony, or Senator Sieben, who apparently is on the division, and maybe Senator Tomasoni has a comment. But if the division undid a policy issue within the division, then by turn the full finance committee can take a look at the same issue. If this was – no, Mr. Chen, you don't have to do that. So I'm not unsympathetic to the general principle, but if it was undone by the division, then it seems to me the division has kicked it over to the full committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
I'm just curious of what the effect of this amendment is. And I realize it deletes line 18 and 19 of the division report, but does it effectively reinstate the?
Yeah. When you say the impact, Senator Tomasoni, I mean fiscally or what?
No. Does it reinstate the two provisions back into the bill by deleting the lines from the
division? That's my understanding, Senator Sieben, of your amendment. Is that correct?
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, it was pretty clear in the finance division that the discussion about these two provisions were that we have mining provisions in a fish and game bill. And there was nobody that was not sympathetic to to the cleanliness of the trout streams or what might end up in trout streams, but it was all about making a blanket decision about where mining can be done and where it can't be done, and that it just doesn't fit in a fish and game bill. And that was not only part of the discussion, but the other part of the discussion was the slippery slope of us deciding where things can be done within miles of certain streams at one part of the state, and then will we suddenly start doing it all over the state. And so this becomes a very, very difficult policy decision to be just outright making a decision on without any kind of input from EAWs, EISs, or local county people. And so the division basically said this doesn't belong in this bill, and that there are silica sand mining provisions in my omnibus bill that is in the conference committee right now that would actually deal with the problem of whether or not certain mining activities can happen within certain areas. We have an EAW that is required for any operations that are of 20 acres or larger, and which might lead to an EIS. There's extension of counties' ability to do moratoriums that they already have the ability to do. There's rulemaking by the EQB. There's forming of commissions in the area so that the local people can make decisions that cross jurisdictional lines. So there's all kinds of things that are in the other bill that we already passed that deal with this, and I just don't believe this belongs in the fish and game bill.
Okay, what I'm confused about, I'll ask Senator Sieben as the maker of the amendment, but where I'm getting really confused is if we're assuming then, or not assuming, Senator Tomasoni, you're suggesting the work of the policy committee was inappropriate relative to the fish and game bill. Is that?
Well, that's what my division decided, yes.
Okay, and so then the question is, should that have been done in division or on the floor in terms of reworking the policy bill? That's what I'm a little bit confused on. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, and just to respond briefly to Senator Tomasoni's point, this is the amendment specifically is talking about protecting trout streams in southeastern Minnesota. And so I do think that it's appropriate. It was certainly appropriate for the policy committee to adopt the provision and therefore is appropriate to be in a game and fish bill. I'd wonder if Commissioner Landwehr is here, if he could provide some testimony on why he thinks that this issue is so important that to be adopted.
Does the commissioner wish to, or Mr. Meyer? Commissioner? Commissioner, if you could identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to recognize that on Saturday I was actually down in Senator Miller's district fishing for trout, and 2 weeks before that I was down in Senator Schmidt's district fishing for trout. It's one of the perks of my job is I get to travel around the state a lot, and I do that anyways because I like to hunt and fish. And
are you going to try to get to everybody's district on the Finance Committee or just
in general? I probably have been to most of the districts already, but I'll be redoubling my efforts this summer to enjoy the fruits of the labors of all of these districts.
My best guess is you won't be trout fishing in my district, however.
But, perhaps not. But
Mr. Chair, I've got a lot of fish in my district. He's welcome anytime. Like,
yeah, you'd be in better shape than I would be. But
well, and for the record, Mr. Chairman, I had better success in Senator Miller's district than in Senator Schmidt's district. So,
welcome back.
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is emphasize how significant trout streams are in Minnesota. We have trout streams primarily in southeast Minnesota and northeast Minnesota along the North Shore. In southeast Minnesota, they're unique because, in large part, the geologic nature of the driftless area, the karst topography, as it's known. And it is a very sensitive topography because of the fact that it is limestone. It is easily fractured and easily interlaced with tunnels. The very river I was fishing on actually disappears for 6 miles underground. The Root River, South Branch of the Root River, disappears for 6 miles between Forestville State Park and Mystery Cave component of the state park. So it's because of the nature of this very porous rock that these trout streams are found there as well. As the water goes underground, it cools, comes out at about 55 degrees, and that's what is able to sustain trout streams. Now, not every stream in southeast Minnesota is a trout stream. The state actually designates trout streams, and they're given certain protections as special waters of the state in many parts of state law. As you all know, and as Senator Tomasoni already alluded to, the Department of Natural Resources has immense authority over mining activities, what we call hard rock mining activities, such as iron ore and non-ferrous up in the Northeast. The commissioner ultimately issues a permit to mine for any mining activity that occurs on the Iron Range of Minnesota, and really gives the commissioner broad discretion. Right now, silica sand mining is regulated almost primarily by local units of government. It is considered a surface resource. It is local units of government that permit those activities. There are no state protections provided to special areas like trout streams. Process of permitting may include comments from state agencies, but the ultimate decision-making is with a local unit of government. We have heard through the EQB concerns from local units of government in that they don't necessarily have all the information they feel they need to issue these permits intelligently, and that there are areas of concern that we don't have good information on. For instance, we don't have good information on groundwater and what we would call the cumulative impacts of silica sand mines that might scatter across a broad area. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to the bill, one of the portions that I really want to express support for is the setback from trout streams. Again, this is a subset of all the streams in southeast Minnesota. The department has no authority to put restrictions on those activities with respect to their proximity of trout streams. And we know because of past experience that silica sand mining activities in close proximity to trout streams can actually result in a loss of water to those trout streams, which percolates through the ground and pops up in the trout stream. We've seen it happen in the past where we actually lost a trout stream because of activity above ground that removed silica sand and interfered with the underground flow of water. So, Mr. Chairman, I just want to close by saying that It is much cheaper to prevent problems than it is to fix problems. We have tended to undervalue our resources, as we're seeing with respect to groundwater in many parts of Minnesota right now. It's easier to look at prevention and conserving resources prior to a problem arising than it is to go in afterwards and fix it. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe this is a reasonable protection for a very important statewide resource, and I would encourage your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that report. And I guess my question is, I know you do permitting under different areas of your purview. Do you, and I think you testified, you do not have the authority to do rulemaking when it comes to different types of streams, trout streams or walleye or wherever. So you do not have that authority now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are, again, trout streams classified as a special water under state law, and it's along with some other types of water bodies like calcareous fens and wild rice lakes and so on. There are statutory protections for actually working in the bed of a trout stream. So that does fall under the authority of the commissioner, as well as water appropriations. Anytime water is appropriated over 1 million gallons, it must be permitted by the state. So we have those two sort of tangential authorities, but none of the activity, I should say, of silica sand mining would typically occur in the bed of a trout stream. And in many cases where there's simply mining and the subsequent processing of sand will occur elsewhere, there may not actually be any water appropriation.
Just to follow up with that, Mr. Chair, if I could. So, I understand this is a new issue. I get that. And unfortunately, I watched the news last night and seen what's going on in southern Minnesota with regards to some folks actually standing in the way of work down there. And coming from that era myself, it's a very uncomfortable position to be in, and I feel for what's going on down there. But is the in your history, Commissioner, with conservation projects in the state of Minnesota, has the DNR shown as much interest in the northeastern part of the state when it comes to trout streams, when it comes to mining? Just for my informational purposes, I've never asked you that before.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, because the department has such broad control over hard rock mining, in conjunction with other agencies like PCA, there are numerous ways for us to weigh in on hard rock mining activities. And the issue that you have perhaps heard most about is with respect to sulfates in water. And, of course, there's a state standard for sulfates in water, and hard rock mining operations have to abide by that, just like silica sand mining operations would have to abide by that if they're actually going to discharge water. But So we do have broad authority over those types of activities in northeast Minnesota. We have designated trout streams in the northeast just as we have in the southeast. So the same protections that do apply to southeast Minnesota trout streams also do apply to northeast Minnesota trout streams. And you may hear later on from a member of Trout Unlimited, but we work very closely with Trout Unlimited in both parts of the state to do habitat improvement projects. And it's fair to say that the state has spent tens of millions of dollars on trout streams in both parts of the state, both by virtue of habitat improvement projects and by public access permits, or easements, rather.
So, Mr. Chair? So, Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner. So there is now restrictions on all trout streams in Minnesota, both northeast and southeast.
The same protections that apply in the southeast apply in the northeast. Oh, correct.
Senator Renoff.
Mr. Chair. Commissioner Landwehr, as I'm listening to this discussion, I'm trying to listen for ways that could both, mitigate some of the concerns expressed by Senator Tomasoni, but be respectful of the community and the concerns in southern Minnesota. And so I thought I heard you say that currently the DNR is responsible for the approval of mining in northeastern Minnesota, but you do not have that same oversight responsibility with southeastern Minnesota, and so therefore this is in response to that. So I guess I'm wondering, why wouldn't instead the approach be to make sure that you have oversight with regard to the approval of mining that comes within a certain proximity to trout streams, so that you're not putting in law a yay or nay with regard to that, but you're giving yourself the same approval authority as you currently have in Northeastern, and therefore Senator Tomasoni's area wouldn't be changed.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not, without having some specific language in front, I'm not 100% certain how to respond to that. I think the difference between silica sand mining and hard rock mining is that silica sand mining can be anywhere from essentially the ground to, you know, 100 feet deep. And it's historically been classified the same as aggregate. So if you want to go take sand and gravel for construction, it's a surface resource, and it hasn't been subject to statewide regulation. And most surface operations for sand and gravel are typically smaller operations. So you think of the county gravel pit, you know, it's 5 acres, 10 acres. It's not the type of activity that is going to have an impact that would be of statewide significance. I think that the challenge we've got with this is we are allowing the local units of government to regulate surface activities, and I don't think that's inappropriate, but by virtue of that activity, there could be an impact on a resource of statewide significance, that is trout streams. And so the difference is we have no authority in the southeast, we do in the northeast.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Landwehr, I guess that's why I'm wondering, why isn't the appropriate language then to just give you that regulatory oversight rather than limit the ability of the locals to within a particular radius? Did you consider that, Senator Schmidt? And Senator Schmidt, do you have any thoughts about this? Because I am sensitive to your community, and I do think that it's important that we protect these natural resources.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, thank you for the questions. And it's a good one. And what we wanted to leave this session with is a firm state standard and to give folks clarity in terms of where it's appropriate to mine and where it's a little riskier in southeastern Minnesota. And in speaking with experts and getting input, we've arrived at these particular standards that are before you today. And that's why we've settled on those. And I think that your points are very valid, but I do think it's important that we, sooner rather than later, try to provide some certainty to this discussion in southeastern Minnesota. And I think that the standards that we've come up with here go a long way in doing that.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a handout that I'd like to get passed out. And I think a lot of this discussion is already accomplished, and I appreciate what Senator Bonoff said. And Commissioner, just for the record, you're welcome in southeastern Minnesota, especially Fillmore, Houston, Winona counties, anytime. And I also want the record to reflect that we absolutely need to protect our natural resources, our streams, our waterways. I'm not sure if we should be having this conversation in the Senate Finance Committee, but we are. But to Senator Bonoff's point, and Senator Tomasoni mentioned this, a lot of this is already accomplished in Senate File 1607, and that's what I'm having passed out right now.
Thank you.
So members can take a look at this, and I'm going to point out some specific sections, but before I get to that, I want members to know, and Senator Schmidt approached me just before this committee hearing today and let me know that this amendment was coming. So the first thing I did is I got on the phone and I called a couple local elected officials that deal with this, and obviously it's a hot topic in southeastern Minnesota, especially in the communities that I represent. And those local elected officials who are have addressed this issue, they're very concerned about the issue, they're working diligently on this issue. They have concerns about the 1 mile setback. And if you look at Fillmore in Houston County, I don't have a map to pass out because this was just, again, brought to my attention today. But this would eliminate just about any opportunity for industrial sand mining in those two counties, because if you go a mile each way of the Root River, that takes up a lot of land space in southeastern Minnesota. So the local elected officials that I spoke to this morning, after Senator Schmidt brought this to my attention, cautioned me. They expressed their opposition to this language. And Chair, now that members have the handout.
Real quick, to help you, Senator Miller, one thing I noticed, the staple's in the wrong place.
I noticed
everybody's
that.
Opening yep. from the back and reading forward, and they're not going to be able to track you as well. As
Senator Lurie, I noticed that when staff gave that to me.
Everybody's
that it was stapled wrong.
I'm looking around the table, and people are struggling.
I was going to mention that. So if I can bring members' attention to Section 74, and I would suggest just undo the staples. It'll be a lot easier. That's what I did.
Thank you, Senator Lurie, for that very cogent point.
Why? You know,
it's that law degree now.
Yeah. So on Section 74, and again, this is Senate File 1607. This is Senator Tomasoni's bill that deals with the environment, natural resources, and jobs and economic growth. That's already passed. I believe it's passed the Senate floor as well. Section 74, line 63.29, talks about the silica sand mining model standards and criteria. And I don't want to read through all this, members, but basically it addresses silica sand projects, temporary storage, transportation, mining sites, processing and storage. And then if you get to subsection 2, line 64.22, it talks about standards and criteria. By October 1st, 2013, the agency and the commissioners of natural resources, health, transportation, in consultation with local units of government, shall develop model standards and criteria for mining, processing, and transporting silica sand. These standards and criteria may be used by local units of government in developing local ordinances. Go on to line 65.3. It specifically mentions designated trout streams, so I think that issue is resolved in this. If we go down to line 65.31, subsection 3, talks about silica sand technical advisory team. Again, by October 1st, 2013, the agency and the commissioners of natural resources, health, and transportation shall assemble a silica sand technical assistance team to provide local units of government at their request assistance with ordinance development and zoning. Go on to page 66, line 66.4, which is subsection 4, consideration of technical assistant team recommendations. When these recommendations are put forward, a local unit of government must consider the findings or recommendations of the technical assistance team in its approval or denial of silica sand projects. And then I also want to mention, Senator Tomasoni also mentioned this, current law says a local unit of government can do a moratorium on this issue for up to 2 years. And Senator Tomasoni's bill actually extends that an additional 2 years, and we talked about that in this committee. So if I'll just mention the counties that I represent, if Houston or Fillmore or Winona County want to extend their local moratorium, they can do that at the local level. And Senator Tomasoni's bill, and it's, I didn't print that off, but it is subsection or section 91 of this bill, says that local county can extend a moratorium for an additional 2 more years. So the local elected officials have concerns with us doing 1 mile. I don't know if Senator Schmidt has a map, but if he does, I would think members, I would appreciate the opportunity for members to take a look at that, because it eliminates a lot of the proposed sites in southeastern Minnesota. And then my question for the commissioner is, or Senator Schmidt, if this language were to be adopted, what would happen for current sand mine operations, industrial sand? It's not necessarily sand that's being used for fracking, but it is industrial sand that are within that 1 mile. Are those exempt? They grandfathered in under this language?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I appreciate your thoughtful response here. I have to tell you, first of all, there's no guarantee that the language we have in 1607 is going to be the language we end up with. I think there's a lot of good features here. I appreciate the attention that Senator Tomasoni has put to this. However, as you run through this, we don't have any specific standards. And we were asked at the state level, to come forth with specific standards on where it's appropriate to sand mine and where it is riskier, and that's what we're trying to get at in these provisions in the Game and Fish Bill. You run through all the language as you did in Senate File 1607. There are no specific standards that relate to trout stream protections, and that's a big concern of mine, and that's why in the Game and Fish Bill and protecting a natural resource. We've taken and made the effort in sections 50 and 51 as proposed to establish those specific standards.
Sarah Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I wanted an answer to the question about current sand mines that are within a 1 mile radius of designated trout streams. Are they grandfathered in, or would they have to stop operations? And then I have a follow-up question as well.
Mr. Chairman, Sarah Miller, the intent is to be prospective here, so there will be effective date moving forward that standard will be put in place.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair and Senator Schmidt, Section 74 of Senator Tomasoni's bill specifically says silica sand mining model standards and criteria. Now, I understand this isn't current law, and I'm not 100% sure what's in the House provision, but I'm hoping that Senator Tomasoni will and the conference committee will fight for the Senate position, just as Senator Bonoff and I are going to fight for the Senate position on the higher ed bill. But thoughts, maybe question to Senator Tomasoni, where is the House on their language that matches up?
Well,
with
there's really not there's not formal rules in committee. We normally don't make reference to what the other body is doing or not. But Sir Miller, if you want the question answered, sir.
Mr. Thomas Chair, the only reason I did is because you mentioned the other body earlier today. So,
I did.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden did too, Mr. Chair, in reference to his.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, I appreciate your questions here and your thoughtful commentary. In my mind, we have one opportunity to get this right, and I want to. That's why we spent the time in session this year discussing this. This issue's been before a number of members multiple times. We can act. I guess we can act ahead of the curve here. We can look to Western Wisconsin, see the challenges they've faced in the last couple of years with this issue, and we can anticipate the challenges that we're going to face if the demand for silica sand picks up and we see more permit requests. What I have in my Game and Fish Bill here is a collection of great provisions to protect natural resources in Minnesota, to encourage hunting and fishing and to get it right. And that's what I'm trying to do with this issue of silica sand mining. And we've been asked to come forth with specific state standards. Those are not listed in Senate File 1607. And there's no provision requiring standards for trout stream setbacks or protections thereof. That's why we have those provisions in Senate File 796, the Game and Fish Bill, protecting our trout streams. We're trying to get this right. And as I've maintained throughout the whole course of this discussion, I'm not married to any single provision as long as we're thoughtful about it and we settle on appropriate standards and processes. I think combined, Senate File 1607, Senator Tomasoni's omnibus bill, and the Game and Fish here put together a process and specific state standards that allow us to get it right in southeastern Minnesota. By no means does this ban silica sand mining. There's plenty of land that would be permitted for mining in southeastern Minnesota. But what it does do is protect the most sensitive areas in this very unique geography, and that's why we're having this conversation. We've come forth with this language.
So, Sarah Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this gets us back then to the original issue started by Senator Fishbach, is that when we're talking about policy here and mining standards being written into the Game and Fish Bill. And I just asked the commissioner, have you ever, are you aware of mining standards ever being written into a Game and Fish Bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not in my short 2.5 years here, I don't believe that's happened.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Schmidt kind of made the points I was going to make. Senator Miller represented that in 1607 the same thing is accomplished, and that's not, in fact, the case. What's accomplished in 1607 are good things, and this actually gets to Senator Bonoff's earlier inquiry. This sets up a process by which model standards and model ordinances are developed. So that the sand mining, like gravel mining, remains in local units' hands. That's fine. I don't think anyone has contemplated subjecting sand and gravel mining to
the kind of permitting that occurs in hard rock mining up in Senator Tomasoni's area. But, you know, to Senator Schmidt's point, this creates some standards to protect state resources because of the sensitive geology of the area up there. You know, and I would, you know, I don't know if anyone got a copy of the letter from Mr. Lencheski that talks about how the groundwater geology works with very, very sensitive trout streams and what the potential is with these kinds of sand mining operations that occur in proximity or go too deep or pump too much water out of the area. I also think it would be useful, Senator Schmidt, if you were to distribute the map that you distributed in Senator Tomasoni's committee, I don't know if you have it handy or can get a copy of it towards the end of the hearing,
sure,
that shows in closer up detail exactly how much area we're talking about. And what was surprising and interesting by that map, because it was different from the larger map, which looked like there was no mining that was going to be happening, there's a lot of space, and it also tracks where the sand resources are. There's still a great, great deal of opportunity for sand mining down in southeastern Minnesota. And I'll just read from Mr. Lencheski's letter that I got before this committee. Minnesota Geological Survey has calculated that mining just 367 acres, approximately one half of 1 square mile of land per year, would supply 40 million tons of industrial silica sand. Current annual U.S. demand for fracking sand is around 30 million tons. So there's a lot of sand down in southeastern Minnesota that supply the national demand, even if that demand grows quite a bit. That's plenty far away from these very, very sensitive trout streams.
Okay, we've had a full discussion. Yeah. Senator Tomasoni, did you have a comment? Yeah, then we probably should vote.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator Tomasoni, or Senator Fishbox?
Really quickly, if we're going to take testimony in this, are we not going to open it up for opponents, too, since we've heard from the proponents? I mean, if we're going to dive into the entire policy issue, I think we should give fair opportunity to everybody.
Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, effectively what and we're not talking about a standard. We're talking about the ban on any mining in Houston County, Fillmore County, Winona County, Olmsted County, Wabasha County, and Goodhue County, and parts of Rice County and Dakota County. And that's basically what this map shows on, if you do what we're talking about here. And members, this is not, as Senator Schmidt says, trying to get it right. This is trying to do an outright ban through law without any kind of studies going on, without any kind of EAWs or EISs or any it's all about somebody saying, well, we think we should just make it a mile from a stream, and that's the deal. Senator Miller pointed out what's in Senate File 1607. That is a very, very good attempt to find out exactly what the situation is and to study it and to come up with recommendations. And if what's in 1607 comes up with recommendation that bans silica mining in all of these areas, well, then you've at least got something going that says we did the work. What we have in front of us is saying the Fish and Game Bill should be the vehicle for banning mining. And Commissioner, to your point about fishing down there, my next-door neighbor just gave me some fresh smoked trout the other day across the alley from me that he caught up north. And it worries me that if we start doing this around trout streams in the south, that we start doing it not only in the trout streams in the north, but we start doing it around lakes in the north, we start doing it around mining pits in the north. Who knows what's going to happen next? And so this is totally the inappropriate place to be banning mining, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we've had a request from Sarah Fishbach for other testimony. There are other meetings scheduled, so why don't we recess and come back at 5 o'clock. Thank you.
Oops. That was a surprise. That was